serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 93-year-old Army Air Corps veteran Richard Cruz, a navigator on B-24s with the 55th Reconnaissance Squadron for weather deciphering missions in the Pacific in World War II. We left off with him describing a flight in which they were losing power, losing altitude, losing time, and had to attempt a landing on a short naval airstrip at Ulithi.
Well, we came in over Ulithi, and their tower is telling my pilot, he says, "You're right over our airstrip. Strip, proceed from there," whatever it was. And he's looking down, and what he's seeing is a strip that was made for Piper Cub Dub airplane was on one of the other islands.
In other words, it's nowhere near long enough for a B-24 typically.
No, and he said, "There's no way I can put this airplane on that airstrip." So he called me up again, and he said, "Look through your drift meter and see if you can see what these guys are talking about." Well, sure enough, right directly below us is their airstrip. Now, I've since found out that that was 3,500 feet long, and I don't think he had ever put a B-24 on a 3,500-foot runway before, more like 5,000 minimum. So anyhow, we get around, and he gets ready to land, and he hit the first 20 feet of that runway. We slowing down, he's on the brakes, our brakes are smoking. He turns at the end of the runway, and the outboard wheel gets wet. So he had used virtually every inch of that runway. Because we went back as soon as we got, and the Navy parked us on a hard stand kind of out of the way, and they came over to see what we were all about. They, I think, got us a Jeep or something. So we went back to look at our tire marks on the beginning of that, and the pilot had put that airplane down the first 20 feet of that runway. Had he gone any further, we probably would have gone off the end, ended up in the ocean at the other end. So he made as good a landing as he possibly could.
And when you told the story about flying into the center of a typhoon, you said you didn't have time to get scared or get nervous. Sounds like this occasion at Ulithi, you probably did have time to fret a little bit.
Yeah, that was over an hour and a half or 2 hours of, you know, starting to lose altitude, hoping you didn't have any further problems except the one engine. So yeah, I had a lot of time to think about. You know, we're a long way from the next landing strip. As it turned out, we probably could have made it all the way back to Guam, but we were vulnerable. You know, we didn't know what he was having a little problem with the number 4 engine acting up, and you know that was making him and everybody else a little nervous. So we did all the right thing as far as that's concerned.
Well, and I don't, you know, want to be dramatic here, but did your mind go to the worst possible scenario there?
Thinking about what it would be like, we'd had some training as to how to handle routine of getting in a 5-man raft, and you know, and how to handle yourself on the water, and those drills were maybe some of the most exhausting things I've ever been through, because it's just very difficult to operate on the surface of the ocean, and particularly, it's not like being at the beach, that's for sure. We were trained to a degree to deal with that, but had we ditched, the comforting thing was there was help close by, but there's no guarantees with those either. So you have to survive the ditch, you have to get out of the airplane, you have to get into rafts, you have to hope everything goes right. So fortunately that didn't happen, and they kept us flying after the war, so we flew till the end of 1945, and then they disbanded the organization, and they just split up all the crews, everybody that hadn't already gone home. And there were 3 of us that had all gone through navigation school. We were on a joining cruise through the transition training at Davis-Monthan and then this weather reconnaissance. We were all young. We were, I think, all the youngest person on the crew, not married. We had the lowest priority you could have as far as going home. So we had to go. They transferred all 3 of us up to one of the B-29 wings, and we just sat there for, I think, 2 months, something like that, you know, we were given orders and put aboard a troop ship to go home.
Was it a big deal for you and your crew or the guys in your squadron when you heard the Japanese had surrendered?
Yeah, that all came in bits and pieces. I had a lady at the Palm Springs Air Museum ask me that one time, and I had to stop and think when it was, because a lot of people think VJ Day is September 2nd when they actually signed the surrender documents. Well, when the first bomb went down, you were hearing the word nuclear probably for the first time. Atom, maybe you'd heard that word before. You were slowly understanding, having some knowledge of the magnitude of that blast. And then, you know, 3 or 4 days later, you get the second bomb. You go through the same thing. We all thought, oh, hey, this is the end of the war. But that wasn't necessarily true. There was a waiting period after that Nagasaki bomb, waiting for the Japanese to agree to surrender. And nobody really knew who was in charge in Japan through that period. And even after they agreed to surrender, and they had broadcast the emperor's respite message, still had to ask a lot of questions as to who was really in control, how were they going to proceed to actually land and set foot in Japan, and you know, what could they anticipate. All of that ended up going very smoothly as far as I know, but it took a lot of negotiation and thinking. And of course, by this time, MacArthur was the guy in charge, and I think he made all the right moves, but that took some time, and it took some negotiation.
And you mentioned the Palm Springs Air Museum there. You volunteered there for 19 years telling your story and helping people understand these airplanes that they were visiting there. And I imagine focusing on this kind of stuff for that long probably gave you a better understanding of the significance of the work that you guys did in that weather recon squadron.
It did, but I didn't learn some of these things till I attended a reunion of the 55th Recon Squadron. At that time, it was in Las Vegas, the commanding officer was still alive, and they'd been having reunions, but this is the first time that we as a crew, there was four of us, I think, were able to attend it. The first time I heard this commanding officer talk about the beginning of it, why this was put together, and the background really came from some of the problems the Navy had of being caught in typhoon situations where they had loss of ship with all hands. And this happened to Halsey. Is covered in a book called Halsey's Typhoon, which is frightening even to read, as to realize what they went through and how helpless they were. So I think the 20th Air Force, when they knew that they were going to put the B-29s into the Marianas, first of all, there was going to be a real need for weather information that didn't exist out there. They couldn't depend on the Navy to furnish that, because the Navy is in a different position every day. You're not going to get a consistent pattern as far as the geography of it is concerned. You can get that by aerial observation or aerial patrol. So that was really what the plan was. And the original 12 crews and the replacement crews really were trained to go almost anywhere that the war in the Pacific was going to lead us. You know, if it hadn't ended the way it was, we could conceivably have been involved on an Asian continent or elsewhere in the Pacific. But because, again, we had planes on Iwo as soon as we could clear it up there. And there's stories up there that I don't think you'll ever find in a history book, because there's a weather front that exists between Iwo Jima and Japan that was causing a lot of problems that they had not anticipated, particularly for the P-51s flying off Iwo to fly cover for the B-29s flying over Japan. On one occasion, they lost 16 P-51s on one mission due to that weather front. Guys got in there, and I had a friend at the Air Museum that experienced that. He was fortunate enough to come out of it, but he was totally disoriented by time, because he was literally tossed around in his airplane like a leaf in a bad storm. And all he knew how to do, I think his compass had tumbled. He couldn't depend on that. He had to find a B-29, and sure enough, he found one. And with hand signals and wigwag and his wings, because his radio was out, he, you know, tried to indicate to them he just wanted to follow them as far as Iwo so he could get back home, which he did. But he said that Curtis LeMay was on Iwo Jima a day later wanting to know what the hell happened. How could you possibly have lost 16 planes? And the answer was, there's a weather front out there we don't know enough about. And so part of the job my outfit had was be to fly up through that front to fly over a target in Japan to get the weather data there, but to check that front going up and coming back. And depending on what they saw, they would either release the P-51s or scrub them, you know, keep them on the ground. They weren't going to let that happen again.
And you mentioned Halsey's Typhoon. Of course, there were three destroyers famously lost in that typhoon, the Hull, the Spence, and the Monaghan. And we've heard from survivors of that on this program. It's so devastating the weather was in the Pacific. And so it sounds like if we were to give a synopsis of your guys' role as a squadron, it was to learn as much as you could about what the weather was doing, basically so you could save lives, right? Save aircrew lives and naval lives.
Yeah, and I think totally everybody was on a learning curve. Again, I have no idea what knowledge the Navy had built over time. I'm sure it was considerable. But the Air Force, this was all going to be all different than what they'd experienced with the 8th Air Force flying out of England, because the weather data there, they had up to 100 years of history of that weather pattern. That's why they were able to call it for D-Day. You didn't have that in the Pacific. So it was a learning curve on all of this. And you're putting a major Air Force with a brand new sophisticated airplane called a B-29 into the Marianas to fly 1,500 miles to Japan and back. It was critical to know what the weather and avoid the kind of thing that Halsey had encountered.
Well, yeah, I mean, even in the instance of those bombs that brought the war to an end, if there had been weather between Tinian and those cities in Japan that they weren't prepared for, those bombs never would have made it.
I'm trying to think of his name, Tibbets.
Paul Tibbets, for those who don't know, was the pilot of the Enola Gay, which dropped that first atomic bomb.
I had a chance to meet him. He made a little talk at the Air Museum, and I told him what I had been involved with. He was difficult to communicate with. He was almost totally deaf. But he said, oh, we had our own weather planes, which I'm sure was true, because he had everything he needed. So he did his own weather reconnaissance. I'm sure he had access to the information we were developing and stuff that was probably being funneled to the 20th Air Force from the Navy. I'm not sure how that was all coordinated, but any knowledge out there he could use, he had access to it.
Well, and I believe the story on Nagasaki goes that that was not the original target, but bad weather over the original target forced him to Nagasaki. So when you consider the role that your squadron played, the work that you did, what stands out to you? What would you say is most significant or gives you the most pride in having been a part of it?
Again, I put all this together over the years after the war because I had no idea, just doing what we were told to do and got it to be a pattern and went ahead and got away with it. You know, I think it was wise to put this outfit together with the capability it had, because I'm sure over the time it enabled them to avoid sending an X number of B-29s on a mission because they knew there was some weather out there. They could delay that or scrub it and go another day. You know, there was a lot that went into the strategy of those raids on Japan. It mostly had me, you know, LeMay was the guy that made most of that happen.
And looking back over the way things were and whatever your perception of the danger you were in was, did you ever feel at all like you were a guinea pig?
No. The only thing, again, this came after when I went to this reunion, and the commanding officer said that in putting that together, in his, they call it a business plan today, he had anticipated losing one crew a month once he got out to fulfill whatever his assignment was. They never told us that at the time, which I was very grateful. He never lost an airplane. He had one plane ditch off of Guam. Everybody got out, was rescued. They had another bad situation up over China. A crew flying out of Okinawa spotted a train, was in Japanese-held territory, decided they'd go down and strafe the train, didn't realize that it was primarily a troop train. They all had rifles, fired back at the airplane. The navigator was hit, badly wounded in the chest area somewhere. The pilot, realizing he had done a dumb thing, burned out an engine getting back to Okinawa. The navigator was in such bad shape they actually had to cut the nose of the airplane off to get him out, and he did not survive. I don't know what happened to that pilot. I'm pretty sure he was court-martialed one way or another. If he wasn't, he probably should have been. Just a bad decision. That is the only casualty that I know of that this squadron experienced in its existence.
And you flew all your hours in the same aircraft?
There was one that we started to have problems with, but this was after the war, when a lot of the top maintenance guys were suddenly going home. They gave us another airplane. They'd given up on this one airplane because it continued to have some problem. I forget what they were, but more engine problems than anything else. And it was just a convenient way to avoid changing an engine, I guess, probably. Anyhow, the maintenance was never a real problem. Our crew chief on the ground, his responsibility was have that airplane ready to go. Every day we were scheduled to fly. We never had to turn back. He always had that thing as it should have been. It was ready to go.
Well, maybe that name was not exactly apropos then, because I saw a picture of your crew in front of that B-24 Jumbo Jim's Jalopy. Where did that name come from?
It was just best we could think of at the time. That was kind of a group effort. I don't know who had the idea, but we did want to name the plane after our pilot. So that was the important thing.
And you know, I've heard a lot of stories. I've heard from B-24 pilots who've flown that bird underneath the span of the Golden Gate Bridge, or, you know, pulled different tricks here and there, buzzed the runway, done things they shouldn't do. And I know that there's a lot of tourism in the Grand Canyon. You can go down by donkey, or you can take a boat tour along the river. I don't think I've ever talked to anybody who flew in a B-24 inside the Grand Canyon. Is that true?
I think I was there because I distinctly remember looking up at the North Rim, and I began to realize we better get out of here pretty quick, you know.
Well, tell us a story. How'd that happen?
Well, I'd probably been on a Cameron bombing mission, I'll say Prescott, and the pilot suddenly called up and wanted to know if anybody had ever seen the Grand Canyon, and nobody on the crew had ever been there. So he asked me to give him a course to the Grand Canyon, which I did. Not very complicated. Anyhow, we got it. We flew over the canyon from east to west, and then I think we went back around to the east end, and he let that airplane down further and further. And I'm in the nose of the airplane looking out the right-hand side headed west. And that's when I realized I was looking up at the North Rim. And because I didn't know what he was going to do. He was going to give us a sightseeing tour, but he gave us a good one. Anyhow, we got down in there, and probably not more than 10 or 15 seconds, but seemed longer at the time.
I wonder how many people you'd get to sign up today if you advertised a B-24 tour of the Grand Canyon.
Well, you'd get a lot of people. We wouldn't believe you, but you'd get a lot of them that would buy that ride, you know.
Speaking of people not believing you, in all those years where you were working at the Palm Springs Air Museum, did you ever get some funny looks when you told people that you were in weather reconnaissance, as in they'd never heard of that before?
Hardly anybody ever had. It's not in the history books. You can find it on the internet, but it's just one of those things, the history of World War II, that I don't think the historian, somebody's probably tucked it in a book somewhere because it did exist. Even the 20th Air Force people didn't recognize us. They were more concerned about the bomb wings and the groups within those bomb wings, and it didn't go much beyond that. And we were B-24s and a B-29 Air Force was the other part of it. Nobody realized that we were part of that, because if you weren't a B-29, how could you be in the 20th Air Force?
I guess I need to ask you, too, since you grew up during this time, you served in this military with 16 million other Americans, you were part of this effort that led the Allies to victory in World War II, but you're well aware that more than 400,000 Americans died in World War II. Were any of those people that you knew, that you reflect on and wonder what he would have done with his life?
Probably the most outstanding guy in my high school class was killed in Europe. He's buried there somewhere, I'm sure. And every time I think about Normandy or the graveyards, the military graveyards, I think of him. John Hayes. He had unique talent. I think he could have done almost anything. East Lansing being a college town. He was the morning disc jockey on WKAR, the college radio station, while he was still a senior in high school. And pretty good. My mother would listen to him. I didn't hear him because I was going to school. But that was an example of his kind of talent, very bright. I often thought he could have been an Arthur Godfrey type personality. He had that kind of brain and instinct, you know. He would have done something significant, I'm sure. Whether it was in broadcasting, I'm not sure. But he had a terrific early start if he had chosen to do that. Johnny Hayes.
Well, if there's anything else that you think we ought to know, feel free to share, but I do want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for helping us understand an aspect of World War II that we don't hear about a whole lot. As you look back on all of it, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I'm just thankful that I was there, that I was on the crew I was on. Great friendships, so I was fortunate in that regard. I would just encourage people to be interested, or if they are interested, to read. There's no end of things you can read to understand the history of World War II from many different angles, but it's all there to be learned if there is interest. And I would just, because that's what I've done. My years at the Air Museum helped that, because I learned a great deal there from people I was serving with. Probably more importantly, people coming in, many of whom had their own stories and shared them with you. And so I value all of that.
Well, perhaps some of those folks are listening right now and they recognize that voice. You can put a face to the voice at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. That is Richard Cruz. And I bet you learned a thing or two today. I know I did. It's amazing how many different ways America's men and women contributed to that eventual victory in World War II. We're out of time for now. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.